It's 8 minutes past seven. It's time for It Says in the Papers with Caroline Murphy.
Enda Kenny makes news today as his calls or plans in three completely different areas make the lead in three papers. The Irish Independent goes with what it says he intends to do for first-time house buyers. Hope for first-time buyers as 10% deposits to return is the headline, with the line underneath explaining Kenny plans scheme to bypass central bank stricter home loan rules. We're told the government is now planning to get around them through a new insurance scheme. Under plans that are still to be teased out, a portion of any new home loan to first-time buyers will be guaranteed by the state. The Irish Times, meanwhile, leads with what it says he will call for from the EU. Kenny presses EU leaders for climate deal concessions is the headline there. We're told that as EU leaders advance a new climate change deal to deal with emissions, the Taoiseach will argue that our dependence on agriculture should be a factor. And the Irish Examiner goes with what he is calling for from Sinn Féin. Kenny, Sinn Féin must tell if rapists were sent to South. Sean Connolly says Sinn Féin has been put under intense pressure by the Taoiseach to reveal anything it knows about sex offenders moved across the border to the Republic. The Sinn Féin leader's call to the Taoiseach, meanwhile, makes the second story on the front of the Times. With many of the papers reflecting Mr. Kenny's meeting yesterday with Maria Cahill in their front page picture choices, the subheadline on the Times' second story is Adams challenges Taoiseach to meet four people allegedly involved in Kangaroo Court. In the piece, we're told a solicitor representing the people named by Maria Cahill in the Spotlight programme has complained of trial by media and has said that the fallout from it has meant that his client's acquittals have been either ignored or devalued. There's plenty more on the Maria Cahill case elsewhere, of course. On page 8 of the Times, Stephen Collins writes under the headline, Cahill leaves Adams and Sinn Féin reeling. While in the Independent, Lise Hand says of the Sinn Féin leader and yesterday in Leinster House, Adams sank in the face of Dáil Storm. The high wire upon which he has balanced with ease for the entirety of his political career bucked and yawned beneath him in the teeth of the onrushing storm, she says, and then he lost his footing. Lost, spent or wasted? Those are surely questions which will continue to be asked of the taxpayers' money which went to the charity Positive Action. And the revelations made on RTE yesterday get plenty of space today. They make the lead in the Irish Daily Mail. Taxpayer cash paid for drink at seminar on liver health is the aspect that paper picks up on. While the front page piece in The Independent is headlined, Blood Charity Spent State Funds on Dog Kennels. But finally this morning, Roscommon's new free man gets attention. The Times reports Chris O'Dowd telling the crowd who gathered to share that freedom that actually I wasn't aware Roscommon had enslaved me. And we're told too that his acceptance speech was like a love letter to his hometown with a bit of slagging thrown in. Like, for instance, he said of his discovery that Roscommon has Ireland's longest life expectancy, I know everyone is surprised. I like to think it's because Roscommon people have more to live for, but it's probably because without an A&E department, we're too afraid to die.
Caroline, thank you very much. 11 minutes past seven. 11 minutes past seven. Brian Finn is here with the business news and supermarket news just in.
Yes, results from Tesco call. A lot of interest in these results because of the overstatement of profits in the group. There was an accounting hole was uncovered recently. And so this is the first set of results to deal with this. There was an investigation ongoing by Deloitte. That investigation has been concluded. It says that the overstatement of the expected half year profit, the impact of that has been confirmed at £263 million. Of that, £118 million relates to its first half trading operation. The balance, which would be treated as one-off items, relates to £70 million from last year, that's the 13 and 14 trading years, and £75 million coming from prior to that. So they haven't given a breakdown of where that money comes from, but we'll look into the results in greater detail at 7:50.
That figure has to do with the entire Tesco company in what, Britain and Ireland?
Yes, yeah. Yeah, this is the whole Tesco. But looking at its UK operations, which are the top line results, it has reported UK like-for-like sales down 4.6% for the first half. And group trading profit came in at just under £1 billion at 0.9 billion. billion pounds. And we'll, as
so
I say,
they're under
we'll
pressure.
More on that later. Indeed, under pressure. There were reports this morning that GlaxoSmithKline is considering floating its HIV treatment division. It's thought the business could be worth up to £15 billion, which would put it on the top third of the FTSE. The flotation is expected to form part of a wider reorganisation that will see major job cuts around the world. In its most recent results, GSK reported operating profits down 37% to just under £3 billion. Asian stock markets closed lower overnight following the lead from Wall Street, which looked like it was on course for a fifth straight day of gains. But the gains were partially reversed following that shooting outside the Canadian Parliament, which saw markets retreat. In Europe, market movements have been fairly muted as investors await the outcome of the bank stress tests. The 130 banks themselves are expected to start receiving the results today, and they'll be made known publicly on Sunday. There have been reports that at least 11 banks had failed the tests, but the ECB has cautioned against any speculation at this stage. Finally, Microsoft has announced that it's ditching the Nokia brand name from new devices. New Nokia Lumia smartphones will instead be known as Microsoft Lumia, the company says. But the brand name, which has been around for nearly 150 years, will not disappear. Nokia's non-mobile division, which is not owned by Microsoft, will continue to use the name. Currencies now: the euro buys $1.26.5 and 78.8 pence sterling. Call.
Most of us will have individual items which we took away from that report by Ingrid Miley on television last night about some very strange spending by the support group Positive Action before it was put into liquidation, largely as a result of investigations carried out by the HSE into how public money was being spent. In my case, it was €185 being spent on dog kennels, of all things. But there are other issues as well about what was going on and what was found out in the HSE's check of what Positive Action was doing with the money that it was getting. Just a question just to begin with. Have we any idea overall how much money we're talking about, how much spending Positive Action did from with state cash?
Well, we do know that between the period of 2000... Now, it must be said that initially this organisation was funded by the Department of Health from its inception until 2005, when the HSE took over. Now, between 2005 and 2013, it was allocated €4,675,995. But between 2009 and 2013, which is the period during which the internal audit was targeted, they got just under €2.3 million.
The HSE report which you obtained into what was going on, is it what you might call an Operation Stable Door job? In other words, something that was commissioned and carried out after Positive Action went into liquidation, or did it begin before?
It began before. I mean, basically, there's been a long history with this. When the HSE took over this, they wanted to find out what was money being spent on, and they, according to this report, they encountered resistance. Eventually it got to the stage where they were trying to get the Positive Action group to sign up to what they call a service level agreement. Now, these would be the sort of agreements you saw with organizations known as Section 39 organizations. That would be groups like Rehab and what have you. They wanted it's basically an agreement that says, if you get public money, here are the rules that you have to abide by, here are the services you have to provide, here is, you know, the level of accountability that you have to give. And they encountered resistance in that when they tried to get the organization to sign up, so much so that Positive Action actually mounted a judicial review against the HSE in relation to that. Now, Positive Action lost that judicial review, and they ended up being told that they had to pay not just their own costs, but 15% of the HSE's costs. So it was only after that that a service level agreement was eventually signed, first on a sort of a halfway house basis, but there was hope that it was eventually signed up on a complete standard form.
Have you got an idea how much they paid in legal fees overall?
Well, that is one of the things that this report highlights as being quite significant. They note that over the four-year period under audit, €776,780 was accrued in legal fees. Now, it breaks that down. €224,113 was paid out. A further 133,479 was accrued. But the report states that the legal advisors involving that informed the HSE internal audit that they were prepared to waive their outstanding costs. Now, the third group of legal fees were 319,187, and that was for the background money for drafting what they call the hepatitis C insurance scheme. You have to remember that at the core of these are a significant cohort of women who were infected negligently by the state through contaminated blood products with hepatitis C. And this meant that they had difficulty getting insurance for the purposes of mortgages, health and all of that. So there had been an agreement that an insurance scheme would be set up. However, according to the report, the internal auditors state that Positive Action went on to hire loads of additional, spent extra money on lawyers. And the HSE insists that Positive Action was always told that it would have to pay those legal fees out of its existing allocation, that there was no way that the HSE was going to pay extra money for lawyers when they were already hiring lawyers to draft that scheme. But eventually it came to 319,187, and they say that they told Positive Action they would not pay that. And in fact, the board minutes of July 2012 in relation to one set of legal costs, now I think this may be for the judicial review, but it's not clear, says legal costs, case very expensive, hopefully HSE / Arthur Cox solicitors will have to cover costs.
Okay, so the total legal bill, we're talking about $750,000 run up over what period?
That's within the period of 4 years.
Right. Okay.
Now, the 319,000 may accrue from previously,
right,
but the fact is that if it remains a liability, they're counting it in.
There was an unfair dismissal case.
Yes, indeed. This was in 2009. The office manager was let go, and the grounds given for that redundancy were, was that the HSE was going to be was cutting their funds. However, the report states that the 2010 funding was used as a pretext for 2009 decision to dispense with their services. Now, this cost ended up costing Positive Action around €68,000 in an unfair dismissal, and the report states that this may have contributed in seriously weakening the internal control framework, and it may have meant that some irregularities could have gone undetected.
The obvious question to finish, Ingrid, I suppose all this money is gone, can't be got back.
Well, we'll have to see about that. At the moment, it looks as if it is. I mean, the HSE ceased funding the organisation back in March, and the directors put it into liquidation in May because, I mean, clearly with no money, they had nowhere to go. But I think it's important to state, Cathal, this organisation did an awful lot of good work. Here was a cohort of women. You may remember the Bridget McColl case and how hard she had to fight and what the state put her through in relation to seeking compensation for what had been an egregious wrong against these women and, grounded in negligence. And this organisation fought like cats to get them, a system, including that hepatitis insurance scheme and what have you. So, I mean, it is sad that there appear to have been some difficulties in the organisation, but it shouldn't be forgotten that they did good work. And indeed, some of the directors who responded to the draft findings and their actual responses are incorporated in this final report, they do say that what makes them sad is that the women in question have lost what was doing good work in many respects.
All right, well, thank you very much, Ingrid. And this is going to be raised, we know, by Shane Ross, Independent TD, at the Public Accounts Committee today. We'll be talking to him about all of this after 8 o'clock. But for the moment, thank you very much.
EU leaders will meet today to decide emissions targets for the next 15 years. But Ireland wants an opt-out of sorts because of its livestock numbers. Taoiseach Enda Kenny will be in Brussels for this meeting. And last week, he said that he was concerned about the changes that have to be made to Ireland's CO2 levels.
It's not feasible to have targets set that are completely impractical for a country like Ireland. And the targets that were set and that were agreed by the administration before this one for 2020 were based on different variations of information that do not stand up. We've had a lot of discussion with the Department of Foreign Affairs, the Department of Agriculture, in respect of the climate change targets that Ireland must meet from 2020 to 2030. So what we need is a practical arrangement statement here that Ireland will play its part. We've set our targets for 2050, but I don't want whatever administration or whatever government is in office in Ireland from 2020 to 2030 to be completely screwed by virtue of a wrong base upon which targets were set originally for 2020.
And Taoiseach Enda Kenny, and also last week the Environment Minister Alan Kelly gave his views on the issue.
Quite frankly, I think our targets for 2020, I don't know how they were put forward by the government at that time. I think they're impossible, they're unachievable, and they should never have been put in place at the first day. They set a target in relation to agricultural emissions, which are outrageous, and they really need to be refocused. And I have certainly made that quite clear at European level, that Ireland really needs the targets which we have been given to be addressed as regards 2030. So for instance, of the targets that have been set to every country across Europe at the time, we were one of three countries that had the highest target. And that is something that we need to pull back from.
That's Alan Kelly. Our Europe editor, Tony Connolly, joins us now from Brussels. So, Tony, not only will Ireland not meet its 2030 targets, it doesn't have a hope of meeting its 2020 targets. And all of this because of our heavy dependence on agriculture.
That's right, Audrey. I mean, I can't remember an issue which has been subject to such lobbying by the Irish government. There has been a fierce lobbying campaign to try and change these targets, and that brings us right into the summit today and tomorrow, where all of the member states are going to be pushing for their own particular interests on how Europe should reach an overall target of reducing carbon emissions by 40% by 2030. Just to put what those comments in context. Targets for 2020 were set in 2008, and they were based at the time on a number of criteria, and there was a simple criteria for use then that was GDP per capita. How wealthy were you? What kind of effort would you have to make based on your wealth? And Ireland at the time, obviously before the crash, was a much wealthier country per GDP per capita. Countries in Eastern Europe obviously had a lot of catching up to do, so they were given more flexibility. But the key issue for Ireland, of course, is in what's called the non-emissions trading scheme. Basically, you measure carbon emissions through two levels. One is emissions trading scheme. That's the big carbon producing factories, power stations and so on. They're subject to credits. So if you want a license to pollute, then you have to buy credits. If you pollute less, then you can sell credits and so on. Now, the non-emissions trading scheme sector, that includes things like buildings, transport and so on. But for Ireland, the big one is agriculture. And what the government is arguing is that our agriculture sector is unique to our economy. Only New Zealand, elsewhere in the world, has a similar profile. And that the European Commission and other European governments really need to take account of Ireland's agriculture profile as a special case. We emit methane gas through the national herd. And that is a very dangerous and damaging greenhouse gas. Now, the government is arguing that because we have a unique profile in terms of our grasslands, in terms of our forests, that those are they mitigate the effects of carbon. They're what are called carbon sinks. So the government is going to be fiercely arguing over the next few days that should be taken account of when the next targets are set.
Well, of course, the French might argue with Ireland's contention that it's unique in this regard. How will other countries react to Ireland's demands?
I think it's been difficult for Ireland because we don't have the normal allies on this one as we do in other areas because we have such a unique profile. The trouble is that everyone is coming at this particular summit with their own set of demands and their own set of issues. One of the big, fault lines is on how you measure a country's profile in terms of its wealth. Now, the countries in Eastern Europe continue to insist that you should measure it by GDP per capita. That straightforward measurement is the best option for them, the best formula for them, because they are still catching up, and that means they will be allowed to have some kind of credits, some kind of European funding, which would offset the effect of having to reduce the amount of coal, for example, that they use, because that the if you're reducing coal consumption, then you will have to pass the cost of that on to consumers, and they are fighting very fiercely on that front. Ireland wants a different measurement. It's something called cost efficiency. We want more account taken of the financial crisis we've gone through, and so on. I think what they will try to do is have some kind of combination of both, but that could be very messy, and there are quite a few countries who are not really in favour of that approach.
Okay, Tony, thanks very much indeed. Our Europe editor, Tony Connolly, live this morning from Brussels.
It's 26 minutes to 8. You know those award ceremonies where you get that few seconds of quiet after the words, and the winner is... For some reason, every year, either the footballers or the hurlers don't get that. The names are given out beforehand. And this year, Des,
the football
good morning,
team
the footballers are out.
Indeed.
And the winners are?
And the winners are in the GAA GPA Football All-Stars. Kerry lead the way. They get 5 awards. Donegal have 4. And the beaten semi-finalists, Mayo and Dublin, each earn 3. There are 6 first-time recipients. Here's the team. In goals, Paul Durkin of Donegal. The full back line, Paul Murphy from Kerry, Neil McGee from Donegal, Keith Higgins of Mayo. The halfbacks, James McCarthy from Dublin, Peter Crowley from Kerry, and Colin Boyle of Mayo. At midfield, Neil Gallagher of Donegal and Kerry's David Moran. The half-forward line has 2 dubs, Paul Flynn and Dermot Connolly. On the wings, Michael Murphy, centre forward, and the full forward line, Killian O'Connor from Mayo, and 2 Kerry men, Kieran Donaghy and James O'Donoghue. Paul Flynn becomes only the 4th player ever to win 4 in a row, which is some achievement, and Kieran Donaghy wins, having started just 2 games for Kerry in the championship, which is also very unusual. In terms of the unlucky ones to lose out, there's a few. Maybe Ryan McHugh of Donegal is one of the more unlucky in that he got man of the match in both the Ulster final and the All-Ireland semi-final. But once Michael Murphy was named at centre-forward, I think...
No chance.
Elsewhere in Gaelic games, another blow for Waterford hurling, as Stephen Malumphy has this morning announced his retirement from intercounty hurling. He's been one of their star players since 2006. Now, busy night in the Champions League last night. Real Madrid outclassed Liverpool as they won 3-0 at Anfield. Karim Benzema scored twice. Ronaldo got 1 goal. The other game in the group ended Ludo Goretz 1, Basel 0. So the Spanish side topped the group with 9 points. The other 3 teams are still on 3 points each. Some reaction now. It's still October, but Cristiano Ronaldo scored his 20th goal of the season for Real Madrid. He has now scored 70 goals in the Champions League and has just won off the all-time record held by Raul.
I'm not worried about that. I know I'm gonna beat this record. I know today or tonight or another game. Me and Messi is very close too, so it's happy. I'm happy because you know it's a good work, it's dedication and hard work. But the best thing it's the team win. We have 9 points, so 75% of the qualification is done.
Elsewhere, Arsenal scored twice in the last 3 minutes to win 2-1 at Anderlecht. Kieran Gibbs and Lucas Podolski with the goals. Arsenal are on 6 points, but Borussia Dortmund have 9 points after a 3-0 win at Galatasaray. Arsenal still in a good position, according to Arsene Wenger, who is celebrating his 65th birthday.
It's in our hands. Dortmund will be a tough opponent, but you never know. They will play now Galatasaray at home. We'll play Anderlecht at home. Let's first qualify. And then we see how far we can go.
Good birthday in the end.
In the end. Thank you.
Yeah, he's a fit 65-year-old Wenger. In Group A, it finished Atletico Madrid 5, Malmo 0. And Olympiacos beat Juventus 1-0. In Group C, Bayer Leverkusen 2, Zenit St. Petersburg 0. And no goals between Monaco and Benfica. Tonight, Everton and Tottenham are in Europa League action. In golf, Peter Lawrie's bid to retain his European Tour card is in trouble in Perth. He's 3 over par after the opening round, 11 shots behind the leader, Australian John Wade. Kevin Phelan shot level par 72. Damien McGrain and Gareth Mabin are both level par midway through their first rounds. In cycling, Chris Froome has hinted he may skip next year's Tour de France and instead target a Giro d'Italia Vuelta España double. In tennis, Serena Williams was beaten 6-love 6-2 by Simona Halep at the WTA finals in Singapore, her heaviest defeat since 1998. And in racing, the action this afternoon is in Thurles, first race at 2:15.
The Private Residential Tenancies Board is a state agency whose central role role, as it says on its website, is to support the rental housing market and to resolve cheaply and speedily disputes between landlords and tenants, offering protection to both parties without having to resort to the courts. Now, today, the agency publishes consultants' reports, two of them, with many recommendations on what needs to be done. But no doubt, disappointingly for most tenants, a finding that rent control would not help them and could reduce the supply of rented accommodation. The author of the reports, Annette Hughes, joins us. Good morning and welcome. Why would rent control not be a good thing?
Good morning, Cathal. Yes, we were asked to look at the potential for rent control, rent regulation, should a political decision be made in its favour. And we looked at a number of models that are in place across a range of jurisdictions. And rent control can take many forms. First of all, if I could just say, you know, the old form of rent control was where you had a rent freeze and you couldn't increase rents. The next form of rent control was where you possibly linked rent increases to some index, like, for example, the Consumer Price Index. And the third and most common form of rent control that we have today is where you regulate the initial rent and possibly the rent increases within the tenancy. So all of those models were investigated in the Irish context.
And you're against all of them?
We are against all of them for the following reason. Because of the particular place we are at in respect of the Irish housing market at the moment, I suppose we looked at a lot of literature and we found that the theoretical justification for rent regulation is relatively weak and is often associated really with unintended consequences for tenants. Now, if you just bear with me, I'll explain to you a number. There are several adverse consequences that arise if you impose rent regulation. And I suppose one of the most commonly cited criticisms of rent regulations in the literature is the potential impact it can have on the supply of new property into the sector. Now, we commissioned, Red Sea commissioned some surveys for us of landlords and tenants, and we found in the surveys that close to 30% of landlords intend to sell as soon as they can, and that's before any rent regulation is put in place. Now, that corresponds to about 50,000 landlords who are looking to exit the sector as soon as house prices recover. In addition, remember, we have about 40,000 buy-to-let mortgage arrears in the buy-to-let sector. Now, they may be some of the same, but potentially, I think if you introduce rent regulation, you run the risk that you jeopardise the stock of property that you currently have in the market, and that's going to have further consequences. For example, there are also issues around the fact that the biggest danger is that obviously investors would overreact to any announcement of rent regulation and would reduce their investment in the sector. But in addition, what happens if you bring in rent regulation is landlords try to compensate for the rent increases they're not going to get. So they will front load the initial rent increase. So rents could actually be higher in a rent regulated market than a non-regulated market.
So for all those reasons you're against, I suppose what your report underlines is, yet again, if we needed an underlining, is that we have an unhealthy property market, we have an unhealthy rented sector, we just don't have enough properties. If you bring in controls with the opportunities people have to sell and make money, it's not going to work.
Absolutely. I mean,
so the answer is
it's not
rent control, is what you're saying.
Well, no, but we have you know, 29 options in this report. We have a number of options around under five headings, which cover, you know, rent affordability, rent stability. We have other options in there around the review of rents to try and moderate the rate of increase in rents. We have issues around protecting the stock, which is very important given where we're at. We don't want to do anything to jeopardise the stock of properties we have in the private rented sector.
What do you mean protecting the stock?
We have about 150,000 landlords in the sector at the moment. Now, as I'm saying, you know, at the moment, approximately 30% of them want to get out of the sector. So can you imagine if 30% of the sector left in the morning, the situation, what would happen with respect to rents?
Right. Okay, just two things briefly. We don't have much time. But one of them is that, as I say, the unhealthiness of the sector is emphasised by the fact that, say, New York and many other cities have rent control. Mm-hmm. So if we're saying we can't have what they have, there's something wrong with the market here.
Absolutely. It's got to do, if you do look at the international jurisdictions, for example, in terms of taxation, landlords, the rented sector is very disadvantaged vis-a-vis the commercial property sector, where they don't get 100% relief on their borrowings. They can't use LPT against write down LPT for tax purposes. But it is an issue around supply, and we have many measures in the report today for tenants in terms of helping
with review of rents. Give us an idea what should be done. And you can, I know it's only a taste. This is going to be online, I presume, very quickly.
Absolutely, it is online.
Give us an idea of what your top suggestions to the government are?
Well, we have a number of medium, short, medium, long term suggestions. We would suggest that those that have no cost implications should happen immediately. For example, we have suggested some measures around the review of rents to help tenants in their negotiations with their rent. Where we have suggested that the notice for a rent increase should be extended to 3 months with for the tenant, that the landlord should provide three comparable properties when looking for a rent increase, and that the PRTB index should be used as the rent index in rent disputes. We have a rent certainty lease which is there, where voluntary arrangement between landlords and tenants where they agree that we'll rent the property on the basis of some
voluntary
index.
Voluntary arrangement would be a nice thing. I think some people would be sceptical.
Well, we have some incentives in place as well to help landlords to take that up.
I'm going to have to stop you there, but this will be online because there's a lot more to talk
about.
There's
a conference today.
And there's a conference to talk about it, but it will be online. But Annette Hughes, thank you very much.
Is the Catholic Church still a cold house for gay people and those who are separated or divorced? On the basis of what was agreed by a synod of Catholic bishops at the Vatican last weekend, it would appear so. They rejected proposals for wider acceptance of both groups. But others argue it's part of Pope Francis's long-term plan for reform of the Church. On the line now is the Catholic Archbishop of Dublin, Dr. Diarmaid Martin. Dr. Martin, good morning.
Good morning.
Were you disappointed or were you satisfied with how things ended in the Vatican last weekend?
Neither, I would say. The synod is a process. If you look at the synod taken together, the temperature is changing in the attitude of the Church towards both people, homosexuals, and people who are divorced and remarried. When you've got a large number, there are 190 bishops, different parts of the world, different backgrounds, the pendulum swings one direction or the other, but you don't arrive at the final vision. The documents that were presented at the end of the synod now come back to be discussed in the churches in each of the different parts of the world, and it's up to the Irish bishops now to take that discussion forward.
Are you prepared to tell us how you voted on the report?
You voted 60 times on the report. I voted in favour of every paragraph. However, there was a real difficulty on some of the paragraphs. You could have voted no, because you felt they weren't saying enough. But then that could have given an even more negative image. I think one of the big things is we all have difficulty in understanding Pope Francis. Pope Francis is an extraordinarily complex person. He came to the synod. He began by saying, look, he said, I got a letter after the conclave of the cardinals in which they said there were some people who were not able to express themselves because the Pope was present. He said, I don't want that to happen here. And things were said at the synod. I know after the first report that came out, one bishop said to me, the Pope just has to intervene. Mm. We can't have this going on. He didn't. He listened. He encouraged people to speak. He's like a father in a large and contentious family. He knows that you won't arrive at a consensus and progress by saying to any group, "You shut up. You can't speak."
But can you explain for people, Dr. Martin, why this is so difficult for many of the Church's leaders? I mean, I've heard from one woman since who's separated from her husband because he was consistently unfaithful to her. She's a devoted Catholic, told by her priest that she could only receive communion if she approached and left the altar with her arms crossed over her chest. Now, she's not alone in that. Why should people like her be publicly humiliated like that?
And I don't think that would be I believe and this again is where Pope Francis you can see very clearly that he wants to reach out to people like that, to understand their situation, to somehow or other to be welcoming with them and to dialogue with them. They spoke about for example to talk about positive aspects in cohabitation. Is revolutionary language in the Church. And some people felt that this was basically canonizing cohabitation. No, what the Pope again is saying there is, let's look at the reality of people. Let's look at the struggles of people. Let's look at people who may be living together, not married, with children. What are their aspirations? What are their hopes? They're not very far away in many cases.
So he has those aims, obviously, and in relation to LGBT people, they and many others take the view that as long as the Vatican and the Catholic Church continues to devalue them and to disrespect them, that that will add fuel to discrimination and to repression around the world. Do you acknowledge that?
I think that, and it was said on a number of occasions, that some of the language used by the Church should not be used again. And I really feel that after the discussions at the Synod, it will not be possible to do that. Now, there were some very strong people who used strong expressions and strong concerns, but they are a smaller group. I think, again, this ability of Pope Francis to recognize that most of us live in the grey areas of life. Everything isn't just black and white for us. And that we have to find a way of being a church in which you do that. At the end of the synod, he had said nothing at all. At the end, then he made this speech where he talked about the temptations that he found there, and one was the temptation to hostile inflexibility, wanting to close oneself within the written word, or the temptation to neglect the teaching of the church, but at the same time, the temptation to neglect reality.
Dr. Martin, we don't have much time, unfortunately, but I just want to move on and talk to you very briefly, if I could, about it's in relation to Archbishop Eamon Martin, what he had to say yesterday about a new relationship between the church and media. But he praised the vitally important role, he said, that the Irish and global media played in exposing child sexual abuse within the church. Now, as we've seen over the past week, allegations of abuse, of cover-up, they extend way past the church into many other organisations. And you'll know what I'm talking about, the allegations involving Sinn Féin and the Republican movement at the moment. And Gerry Adams has said that, you know, to quote him, these actions were of their time and reflected not only a community at war, but also an attitude within Ireland, which did not then understand or know, as we now do, how deeply embedded abuse is in our society and how to deal with it. Is that a good enough response?
When I became Archbishop, I took a very strong line in trying to get the truth out. And one of the answers I got was, well, you weren't here at the time, you didn't understand the culture. When I read and met with victims, and above all with the parents of the victims of children, they knew it was wrong. Parents knew. Parents came to bishops and said, I don't want this to happen to anybody else. They weren't out for to get at anybody. They just realized that this was something that should not happen. And it was there in people's lives. You know, people say to me, you know, we didn't know about pedophilia. My mother told me not to take sweets from strangers, and she wasn't worried about my digestion. She knew that, you know, there was a problem there, and that this existed, and that it was wrong, and that it was bad for and dangerous for children.
So what would you say to Gerry Adams?
I would say to anybody, let the truth come out. Let the truth be investigated in a transparent, open way by the competent authorities.
Thank you very much indeed, Archbishop of Dublin, Dr. Dermot Martin. And Brian Finn is back with the Business News. Hi, Brian.
Audrey, thank you. Tesco has reported pre-tax profits down over 90% to £112 million in the 6 months to August. It also said the investigation into the recently uncovered profit overstatement had resulted in a £263 million correction. Its chairman is standing down. Mark Manan of Cantor Fitzgerald is here. Mark, let's start with the results. Profits down over 90%. Was that expected?
Well, the numbers are, albeit fairly gloomy, they are slightly better than most analysts were expecting. Obviously, there was worries over how large this accounting issue might be. As you said in the intro, it came in at £263 million, of which £118 million relates to the numbers that have been announced today, the H1 numbers. Obviously, I think the statement draws a line in the sand underneath this, so that will be taken well by the markets.
Is that investigation over now? That's finished?
It seems to be over, yeah, according to the statement. So that will obviously be reasonably well taken by the market. The obviously something else that will be well taken by the market is the outline that there's a succession plan going to be put in place for to find a new chairman. Obviously, the current chairman was in place when a lot of the issues and the poor performance of the company from a sales perspective. So I think the change in the management team, ultimately, when that happens, will be taken well. on the more gloomy side within this statement, the like-for-like sales in both the UK and Ireland have been, you know, under pressure, and they're very difficult time. But the like-for-like sales down 5.5% in the UK and 6.4% in Ireland. So, you know, the outlook for the company is very difficult there.
Is that the pressure of the discounters?
Yeah, it seems the line from the statement was that it's due to intense competition from discounting and couponing. You know, the company is really struggling, as are its other retailers, struggling against a backdrop of, you know, increased competition from Lidl and Aldi, and then also very significant price competition from peers such as, you know, Morrison and Sainsbury.
The CEO is talking about shoring up the balance sheet. What would that entail?
It's hard to know. They have said briefly that they're looking to shore up the balance sheet. There is a significant pension deficit within the company. There has been talk of them wanting to raise up to $1 billion to find $1 billion to get involved in an intense price war as well with some of the peers. So it's difficult to know where those funds are going to come from. They have very significant Asian assets. They also have a company called Dum Humbee, which is speculated to be worth about £2 billion pounds. So, you know, that is what, you know, the company that runs the club card side of the business. So there are assets there that they, you know, they could potentially sell or float to raise further funds.
Mark Murnane of Cantor Fitzgerald, thank you very much indeed. Just finally, currencies. The euro buys $1.26.5 and just under 79 pence sterling.
It's time for the weather from Evelyn Cusick at Met Air. And Evelyn, good morning.
Hi, Cathal. Good morning from Met Air. And it's another very mild morning across the country, and staying mild today with temperatures reaching 13 to 16 degrees Celsius, though the edge taken off these a little bit in fresh southwesterly winds. Now, it will be mostly dry in the east and south with some brighter sunny spells, though we do have a weather front moving in from the Atlantic, bringing in cloud and some outbreaks of rain and drizzle, but rainfall amounts will be quite small, but nonetheless turning damp and drizzly in places. Indeed, it is already quite drizzly in parts of the northwest at the moment. But a mild and, as I said, a breezy day. That cold front continued to push southeastwards this afternoon and evening, giving some light rain or drizzle in places, then clearing early tonight and much cooler conditions tonight, but still no sign of frost with lowest temperatures 5 to 8 degrees. And tomorrow, Friday, cooler than today. We will be in a cooler air mass. Bright, fresh conditions with sunny spells and dry, apart from a scattering of showers. Highest temperatures up to average about 10 to 13 degrees. And it will be cool and windy tomorrow night. And then for the weekend, the bank holiday weekend. Weather fronts will track near or over Ireland over the bank holiday weekend, giving windy and quite cloudy weather generally with scattered outbreaks of rain. And some heavy rain is possible at times, in particular in the northwest. But there will be dry spells, and these most likely for a lot of the weekend in Munster and Leinster. So Saturday, a fresh and very windy day with sunny spells, and in the west and north, some showers. And temperatures up into the mid-teens on Saturday, but as I said, very windy. For Sunday, the wind's easing a little, cloudy conditions with scattered outbreaks of rain, but sunny spells in the east and south, and more likely to be more widespread rain around us on Monday. But overall, very, very mild on Monday, temperatures up to 16 degrees, as indeed there will be today. Some sunshine today, but some light rain extending from the northwest. Good morning.